In case of emergency, get out of my way.
This is the Blackwater Ethercast.
Notoriety is occasionally useful. One of its side effects is a constant audience watching your every move and deed. Sometimes, I must admit, it can be quite convenient to have such a following. A well-placed hint can send an unsuspecting fellow searching for evidence in entirely the wrong places. Unfortunately for me, my audience of late has grown, quite apart from you, dear colleagues, and at some point, the Intrepid League once again caught wind of my actual plans and decided to interfere in the most unrefined manner. The commissions I take are my own business, and I will not tolerate outsiders policing my personal dealings. This is a lesson I sincerely hope the most recent visitor to my castle learned. As the noise behind me suggests, I am once again using the portable Ethercast transmitter while aboard a ship. The lesson was taught at a certain cost to its teacher. I was using my Glenwalker, Percy's, to pace out an area for a structure I had need to begin work on soon. The bipedal vehicle is excellent, not only for giving me an extra 8 feet of height to see and plan from, but I am able to make exact measurements by merely counting its mechanically regular steps. The gully, the small glen, seemed deep enough, but was there enough room between its steep walls to contain what I needed to build? As I passed by a short cliff at the side of the gully, my measuring was interrupted by a sudden, "Aha!" and a young man dropped onto Percy's left haunch from above. "I have you now, villain!" One expects the occasional attempted intrusion by would-be heroes into one's home. After all, that is why one hires guards. But this was becoming intolerable. "Get off, you ridiculous twit!" I jolted the Glenwalker back and forth, producing a colossal jig. The young interloper tried to hold onto the pipes at the top of the central structure, but his hands slipped under the onslaught of bucking, and he was thrown upright, hands windmilling comically before he tumbled to the ground. I sighed heavily and waited for him to regain his feet. "What the devil are you doing, Eugene? What do you mean to achieve by all this?"
"I have come here to thwart your evil scheme."
"Yes, well, you're going to need to be a little more specific. For one thing, your idea of evil seems rather randomly applied. I would be hard-pressed to even guess which of my projects would meet with your moral approval."
"Precious few, I would imagine."
"Indeed. On that point, at least, our imaginations agree. So what precisely about my latest efforts qualified them for your renewed attempts at interference?" He gestured at my walker.
"The mere presence of this monstrosity speaks for itself. This affront to nature. There can be no question but that whatever you are planning must be stopped."
"Now just a moment, Intrepid Agent Eugene Blair. What right have you to interrupt a pleasant walk in the glen and on my own land? You object to the size of my conveyance? Did you perchance arrive in Perthshire by way of locomotive? What gloriously monstrous mechanized travel that is! So enormous, so dangerous, so obnoxiously loud! Such a bending and harnessing of nature to the collective will of man! And inside, defiant of all nature's elements of wind and sun and rain, even of the need to exert oneself to travel from the comforts of Cambridge to the rough cold wilds of the Highlands, you rode at ease, and very likely at someone else's expense. And now you lecture me about a pair of mechanical legs.
Begging your lordship's pardon, but I paid my own way this time, and the locomotive which drew the cars in which I and the other grateful passengers rode is an example of one of the great benefits to mankind. As you well know, many of the advances which occurred in the past century could scarcely have happened without the railway's ability to transport labor and materials, and very cheaply indeed, which has benefited great and small throughout the world. and in fact the poor in particular. On top of this are the gains in technology and industry by the mere creation of the railway network, the enjoyment and appreciation of the world and nature, yes, as seen from the carriage windows, and more. But this contrivance in which you ride benefits only the man who made it, and that which was learned and gained by its development will surely remain locked in the dark mind of its creator. Do you think I built every part of this by my own hand, that I mined and smelted and alloyed the metal in the castle kitchens, that I wound every spring and cut every cog? The industry and livelihood of many have been supported by this single effort, but even if they had not, what I build and what I do are my business only. I do not answer to you. I answer to King and Parliament alone, and only when I must. And they have had the wit to not inquire too deeply. Mr. Blair began to object on grounds of the general good, or some such nonsense, and I took advantage of his distraction as he assembled his thoughts to turn and push the Glen Walker to its highest speed, back toward the castle grounds. After a few steps, I heard a complaining, "I say," from behind me, but it was too late for him to catch up with me. It was a matter of only a couple of minutes until I re-entered the side gate. Once inside, I paused long enough to tell the guards to repel the irritant which was following me. As I entered the Walker's outbuilding, I heard some shouting at the gate, followed by a pair of gunshots. The guards had performed their task quite satisfactorily. Drusus, son of the Emperor, has caught Sejanus planning to seduce his wife. After he leaves, Sejanus vents his displeasure. If this be not revenge, when I have done and made it perfect, let Egyptian slaves, Parthians, and barefoot Hebrews brand my face and print my body full of injuries. Thou lost thyself, child Drusus, when thou thoughtst thou couldst outskip my vengeance or outstand the power I had to crush thee into air. Thy follies now shall taste what kind of man they have provoked, and this thy father's house crack in flame of my insensate rage, whose fury shall admit no shame or mean. Adultery, it is the lightest ill I will commit. A race of wicked acts shall flow out of my anger, and o'erspread the world's wide face, which no posterity shall e'er approve, nor yet keep silent. Things that for their cunning close and cruel marks, thy father would wish his, and shall perhaps carry the empty name, but we the prize. On then, my soul, and startle not in thy course. Though heaven drop sulphur, and hell belch out fire, laugh at the idle terrors. Tell proud Jove, between his power and thine there is no odds. 'Twas only fear first in the world made gods. It was only a half hour later, as I passed through the dining room, that I heard Mr. Blair's voice again. Surely you didn't think you'd be rid of me that easily. I admitted my lack of surprise, adding, I hope you limited the damage you caused on the way in. Oh, your guards should recover just fine. I'm not after your deluded followers, Baron. He drew a pistol and gestured my direction. I'm after you. Come quietly, and we shall see justice done peaceably in a court of law. I walked up to him so that the pistol was only a foot from my chest. Surely, you must be joking. You know very well that my constructions and experiments are quite legal, though perhaps unwise for someone less capable than myself. As for justice, what justice is there in interrupting a man's productivity? With a sudden open-handed strike at the back of his hand, the pistol flew to one side of the room. We both leapt at it and struggled for its control. Switching tactics entirely, I squeezed his fingers together and used his own hands to send the weapon crashing through a pane of the nearby window. He leapt backward and grabbed a candlestick from the room's mantle as I quickly armed myself with a couple of pewter plates from the table. You produce in the service of evil and destruction. What bizarre turns of phrases you use, Mr. Blair. Do you complain that I occasionally build weaponry? I'll readily admit that destruction is usually far easier than construction, and sometimes as enjoyable. But do you likewise condemn Hotchkiss and Gatling, and Webley, whose workmanship just sailed through my window? he pressed his attack, battering away at the plates. Of course not. A nation must be able to defend itself from foreign dangers and its citizens from the lawless among them. All too often in history, simple might becomes the only enforcement of civilization, and reason is too easily overcome by mere power. Americans sometimes call their guns equalizers because they allow the otherwise weak to defend themselves, but we have seen your weaponry in action before, have we not? Strange, unnatural, and overwhelming forces unleashed for no reason but to further your own ends. Instead of protecting equality and meekness, they can have no function but the opposite.
Is this your definition of evil, then? That a person or thing not sacrifice its inherent values to serve the odious and ridiculous fiction of sameness? That the extraordinary should not be extraordinary? Were I to follow this morality that you champion, I would have to be ashamed of my exceptional nature, and would voluntarily lower myself from the heights my mind can achieve in order to become like everyone else.
No one argues that the exceptional should geld their abilities. What must be reined in are the dangerous impulses, the aggressive, the outrageous. Let the exceptional make their creations in the service of the greater society, according to the guidelines of decency that have been established for the safety of all. That is the meaning of good, and flouting it, a useful meaning of evil.
With that, he struck one of my increasingly damaged plates from my hand. I threw the other like a discus at his midsection, knocking the wind from him. I ran into the hallway and toward the staircase. A footman entered with curiosity from the drawing room, but when I ordered, "Stay back," he disappeared again through its door. At the top of the stairway, I ducked into the general library and flipped the door closed behind me, then toppled a nearby chair as I passed it. Mr. Blair caught the door with his shoulder and blasted it open, but tripped over the legs of the chair. By the time he had recovered, I was on the opposite side of the desk and had slipped the pistol kept in its main drawer into my waistcoat. As he re-established his footing, I told him, "The rules of society that you hold so dear are, yes, a necessity, but not for me. They are for the foolish and those of common intellect who must follow such conventions to know what they should do. Conformance to the norm encourages useful behavior and discourages bad. The vast herds of mankind are apathetic and directionless, calling any whim that outlasts a day a passion, without having any idea what commitment to their internal compass could really mean. I am not to be counted among them, and I must not act as though I were." He composed himself, straightening his clothing, and gave me a reproachful look.
"You consider yourself a higher creature? Does your psyche demand such an excuse for ignoring the laws of society, of decency?"
"You, of all people, demand this of me. What do the laws of decent society have to say about invading a man's home?" I snatched up a copy of Aristische Dialectik from a shelf and flung it at Blair. He batted it out of the air.
"Decent society demands that someone protect it when it is threatened. If that means doing what would otherwise be considered unlawful or impolite, then that is what must be done."
He went to a weapon display which decorated a space between bookshelves and snatched a saber from it, turning to me and adopting a formal, on-guard pose. For my part, I picked up my favorite walking stick from its place beside the desk. If we have met, you have probably seen it. It's topped with a dinosaur claw, the fossil's curve comfortable in my hand and lending an air of strange authority. Today the claw acted as the pommel from a blunt, brass-tipped makeshift rapier. Blair raised his eyebrows.
"Really?
Come on, lad, show me your technique." He hesitated a moment, so I broke him out of it with a slash at his head. His instincts moved his sword to block, and then he finally responded. I caught his first overhead strike with the shaft of the walking stick, which didn't so much as dent. Blair looked startled. "Ah, I should probably tell you that this is no normal walking stick, and also that the swords in that decorative arrangement have not been sharpened in a very long time. Shall we carry on, then?" We engaged in earnest, exchanging thrusts and lunges, ranging round the library in our attempts to get the better of our opponent.
You cannot fool or confuse me, Baron. I have researched your actions and your creations, and I know who you are.
Oh, really? Let us explore how well you know your subject matter. What is my family name?
Elphinstone, of course. This is public knowledge. You attended Oxford and have a particular interest in clockwork devices. Come now, ask a harder one.
Public knowledge, indeed. Can you put together even the things you think you know from public knowledge? When was I born?
I'm sure I don't know. No one has ever mentioned it that I recall. You look a relatively youthful 50, though your, strength and endurance seem like someone in his late 30s, perhaps. Your father was the 4th Baron Blackwater, who, with his wife, your mother, died of typhoid when it swept through Britain in...
His words and attacks both trailed off, his eyes widening in confusion. I took the opportunity to drive him back with several vicious slashes. Yes, you think you know who I am. You don't even know what I am. I flipped the walking stick so that its head, the curved claw, was toward my opponent. He naturally assumed I was changing to a clubbing style of attack, much slower and easier to deflect, and I saw his eyes light up with the possibility that he might quickly win. But I had grasped it several inches from its end, restoring most of the lost agility at the cost of some reach. He engaged in a series of beats, looking for an opening. He blocked a weak attack from the end of my weapon with a strong base of his sword, which against another sword is naturally, even automatic. Block the foible with the forte and move on. But he was not fighting against another sword. The instant it was blocked, I hooked the fossilized claw around the blade where it met the handguard and flipped his hand away from me. The motion led easily into a moulinet, the weighted head accelerating through a circle to smash into his forearm with a loud crack. Mr. Blair cried out and clutched his arm near the elbow, his sword falling at my feet. He staggered back against the wall and looked at me with defiant hopelessness.
You have bested me, villain, but you have done so honorably. I accept my end, knowing others will avenge me.
I assure you, Eugene, if I wanted you dead, you would have been some time ago. But there's no need for that. Do you think we would have had this discussion if my intent was to return you to Cambridge on ice? You do not intend to kill me? I see no call for it. But in the future, you should remember that I am not one to interfere with, and also that my business is my own. And lastly, that you should learn to restrain your histrionic tendencies. Honestly, if one considered a mad scientist suggesting that you keep your dramatics more under control, you may want to think about adjusting your behavior. In any case, you arrived too late to prevent anything at all. The weapons have not only been completed, but delivered.
But I saw you testing it this very afternoon. You threw me off it only an hour ago.
Percy's. My Glenwalker.
Yes, the key is there in the name, Percy's the Destroyer. You plan to arm your bipedal contraption with some nefarious new weapon and sell it to the highest bidder, or worse, use it to conquer England yourself.
England? What would I do with England? A terrible nuisance. No, my walker is named for a titan because it is enormous, but it provides no service beyond locomotion and a better viewpoint. As for its namesake, in spite of his name, I am unaware of any myth in which Percy the Titan actually destroyed anything. Still, now that you mention it, arming my walker is an excellent idea. Perhaps I'll get around to doing that. Even then, there would be little point in using it against an army. Britain is only one of several nations already experimenting with armored walkers of various kinds. It would be like charging a line of cavalry in a dogcart. Mr. Blair looked confused for a moment.
But if the weapon isn't your Titan Walker... Wait, you said it had already been delivered? They had already been delivered. Could this be what our agent in Dundee observed? Dora, Miss Gray, spotted a pair of large crates which she believes were delivered from the area of Glenshee. They were loaded onto a mail ship bound for northern France, for Calais. Who would have commissioned weapons from you in that region? Who would you have supplied? My god, man, the suppliers! We have long suspected that such a secretive industrial cartel dealt in more than mere tariff dodging. They have become, or have always been, arms dealers, delivering mechanical horrors bought from you, Lord Blackwater. I cannot believe that you would be party to such a thing.
You know, I rather imagine you can.
Yes, well, all right, yes, I expected something like this all along. But now I know where you have sent them, and when, and, aha, even how, and we shall foil your nefarious plan at last.
Well, now I do have to kill you. I retrieved the small pistol from my waistcoat and pointed it at Mr. Blair. His momentary expression of alarm quickly turned to one of determination. His eyes darted to the nearby open window, and in an instant the rest of him followed. We were not on the ground floor anymore, so I imagine his cry upon landing had as much to do with his broken arm as with the shrub he had blindly leapt into. I went to the window and shouted, "Guards!" Mr. Blair had already extracted himself from the shrub and was making for the perimeter as quickly as he could while cradling his arm. A pair of guards appeared in a moment and pursued him out of the grounds and toward the town. As soon as I saw them call out and run, I returned my attentions to within the castle. "McThomas, the Intrepid League will shortly be on their way to Calais. We must arrive there first if we can. Minimal entourage. Yourself, bodyguards, and, have young Mr. Reed attend while on board. He shows promise as a steward. It should be a brief trip, but we must go well armed, and bring the portable Ethercast transmitter. We leave in 1 hour." And now here we are, halfway to France. Some of you, I know, consider it a character flaw, this impulse of mind to see things through in person. It is better, many argue, to exercise one's power from a distance. And indeed, that is one of power's primary functions, and further, that it is hardly in the nature of the scientist to venture from laboratory and library. But as you know, I have never had what one would call a normal relationship with nature. More to the point in these matters, it is important to know when to delegate and when to take the wheel oneself. Only complete knowledge of circumstances, familiarity with the persons involved, and the agility of intellect to direct the flow of events can allow a complex and delicate situation to end well. But if the League responds more quickly than I believe they can, it could all go badly, after all.
The Blackwater Aethercast is written, produced, and performed by Nicholas Jovian. Additional voices by Kayla Thomas. Beginning and ending music is by Derek and Brandon Fichter. They can be found at dbfichter.bandcamp.com. Today's entertainment was from Sejanus, His Fall by Ben Johnson. Be sure to subscribe to the Aethercast and send your friends lordblackwater.com so they can too. A new chapter is released twice monthly. Also, visit lordblackwater.com to be featured entertainment. And thanks for listening. You're welcome.